This is Live at Politics and Prose, a program from Slate and Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C., featuring some of today's best writers and top thinkers.
You know, I can tell from just glancing around the room here that that many of you were alive in 1974. I know. Come on. I mean, I know I was. And if you were, chances are you remember the kidnapping of Patty Hearst by a small, previously obscure group of self-styled violent revolutionaries who called themselves the Symbionese Liberation Army. The kidnapping became one of the defining events of the 1970s, unfolding live on nationwide TV. It riveted viewers for months as Hearst, a granddaughter of famed publisher William Randolph Hearst, appeared to side with her captors, posed as a machine gun toting Tanya, or her nom de guerre, joined in robberies and conspired to set off bombs. Arrested after 19 months and charged with robbery, she mounted a brainwashing defense, which helped dramatize a term that was just then emerging, Stockholm Syndrome. Hearst was convicted and sentenced to 7 years, but Jimmy Carter signed a commutation after she had served only 22 months, and Bill Clinton ultimately pardoned her. She married, wrote a memoir, published a couple of years after her release, and has gone on to lead a life of comfort and privilege on the East Coast. Jeffrey brings new information and insight to what we thought we knew about this extraordinary story. Hearst refused to cooperate with him, but he had the benefit of thousands of pages of legal and investigative files collected by a former SLA member, as well as interviews he conducted with more than 100 people connected with the case. Jeffrey, of course, is very experienced at reporting and writing about legal stories. He's been covering legal affairs for The New Yorker since 1993, and has appeared frequently on television as a legal analyst, starting in 1994, for ABC and then shifting 4 years ago to CNN. He's also written six previous books, including one about the O.J. Simpson trial, which was the basis of that FX TV miniseries earlier this year. The reviews of Jeffrey's new book, which is titled American Heiress, have been very positive. They've called the work riveting, illuminating, and objective. As for the central question, was Hearst actually a brainwashed victim or a willing participant in the SLA's crimes? Well, you should read the book and make up your own mind. So, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Jeffrey Toobin.
That's all right. I'll do like a little Wayne Newton thing here. Hello, everyone. Wow, what a great crowd. I'm so happy to see you all here. This is terrific. Say hello to my wife, Amy McIntosh, over here. Washington insider. All right, so the first question a lot of people have about this is like, well, why did you decide to write this book about this now? And that question actually has an answer, which is I wrote a piece for The New Yorker, gosh, I guess it's pushing 3 years ago now, about a gang that took over the jail in Baltimore. You're all in this area. I'm sure you remember that. If not the piece, you remember the story. It was called the Black Gorilla Family. And they took over the jail, and the guards were mostly women, and women got pregnant. It was a very distasteful and totally great story. I wrote a piece about that, and I got interested in the history of the Black Gorilla Family, which was the gang that took it over. And it turns out the Black Gorilla Family was founded by the famous prisoner in the California Soledad prison, George Jackson. He wrote a book called Soledad Brother. He wrote another book called Blood in My Eye. He was ultimately killed by the guards. I got interested in the history of the prison movement in the 70s. In the 70s, following the Attica riots in New York, prisons, especially in California, were hotbeds of political activity. And a lot of counterculture figures went to prisons to try to organize prisoners for political activity. And I went to lunch with my editor at Doubleday. I didn't have a book topic at the time, and I was telling him about this. And he knew, as I knew, that the Symbionese Liberation Army also came out of the California prison movement. And he said, well, what about Patty Hearst? And I had not really thought of it at that point. And I said to Bill at that point, I said, well, there must be a million books about Patty Hearst. And he said, well, go check. And to my surprise and delight, I learned that nothing had been written about the Patty Hearst case in more than 30 years. I mean, the story was, of course, a very familiar one to people who were of a certain age. But nothing new had been written. So I started looking into it and decided to write a book about it. And I think one of the great things about this story, which is essentially 40 years ago, is that at once it is a story about a very different America, but it is also a story that has a lot of modern resonances. And the first thing that struck me in reporting this story was what it was like in America in the 1970s. Now, as someone – I was a young teenager when this was all unfolding. I was alive, but I wasn't particularly politically aware or following this as a journalist. And I had the conception in my head that the 60s were the time of tumult in America and things sort of settled down in the 70s. Well, I am here to tell you I could not be more wrong. The 70s were this extraordinary time of violence and unhappiness and tumult in America to a degree that shocked me. And I will give you one statistic that is, I think, the most shocking statistic in American eras. And that is, during the early and mid-1970s, there were 1,000 political bombings in the United States every year. Think what Fox News would do with that today. I think what they would do with one political bombing, 1,000 political bombings. Now, they were not all fatal, although some of them were. But this was a time of tremendous political violence, especially in Northern California. Northern California, you had the free speech movement in Berkeley, 1965. You had the Summer of Love in San Francisco in 1967. But by the early 70s, all of those movements had curdled into anger and resentment. And most of the sort of middle-class kids who were behind it, once Richard Nixon ended the draft in Vietnam, they fell away. And all that was left in the politics of the 70s, or the counterculture of the 70s, were the really hardcore. And that... And that's who were the people who were behind the Symbionese Liberation Army. It was the time of Watergate. It was the time of the energy crisis. I mean, America really was falling apart, and San Francisco in particular was this epicenter of violence. The thing that I have come of age at a time when San Francisco was this cool city with high tech and near Silicon Valley. What you forget, or what I certainly forgot, is that Dirty Harry, Clint Eastwood's detective, was a San Francisco detective because that was the symbol of disorder and violence in America. And it was the time of the Zodiac Killer and the Zebra Killer, these serial killers who were out in San Francisco, this feral anger that was out in San Francisco. And that was what the SLA grew out of. Now, who were the SLA? The SLA, as I said, there was this movement of prison activists, and there was a prison called Vacaville, which is the nearest major state prison to Berkeley. And there was a group of students and ex-students who would make regular pilgrimages to Vacaville to organize and talk to and educate and commune with the inmates at Vacaville. And one of the inmates at Vacaville was a guy named Donald DeFreeze. And Donald DeFreeze was basically a small to medium-sized hood who had been in and out of prisons his whole life. And he saw these young students as an opportunity and a meal ticket, in part for sex, because there was lots of sex, even in prison. And there was also the opportunity to get out. And Donald DeFreeze was transferred from Vacaville to Soledad State Prison, and in early 1973, he escaped. And where did he go? He went to Berkeley, because he had known these idealistic and otherwise engaged students who had been visiting Vacaville. And so he moved in with these students and their allies, and that group became the core of the Symbionese Liberation Army. Now, you may ask, Symbionese, what the hell does that mean? It is a word that DeFreeze made up. He said it was it came out of symbiosis, the idea of people coming together. You know, And he called it the Symbionese Liberation Army. And it's worth remembering that the Symbionese Liberation Army, Symbionese is not a word. They didn't liberate anything or anyone. And as an army, this group had at most a dozen people in it. So, you know, it like much of the SLA, it was a comically overstated, they overstated their own significance. But he found a receptive audience in this group of students and ex-students. A lot of people to this day think of, oh, well, the SLA was one of these like black radical groups like the Black Panthers. There was exactly one African-American in the SLA, Donald DeFreeze. All the rest of them were middle-class white kids who looked to DeFreeze for guidance. And as we saw, God help them, because DeFreeze was an idiot, an angry, drunken bum who had some ridiculous ideas about politics that he brought along this naive and also pretty sinister group of students as well. And his first project that he decided to do, he was living, you know, as an escaped prisoner, and he decided the Oakland school superintendent, a guy named Marcus Foster, a really heroic figure in this period, an African-American from Philadelphia who tried to, you know, fix the Oakland schools, which were, you know, a disastrous shape. And DeFreeze, in his madness, decided that Foster was a rival for the leadership of the African-American community. I mean, nobody thought Donald DeFreeze was the leader of anything. But in November of 1973, Foster and two other members of the nascent Symbionese Liberation Army assassinated Marcus Foster in cold blood, a crime so incomprehensible that every part of the political underground, the Black Panthers, the Weather Underground, rejected what they had done. But that's the beginning of the kidnapping of Patty Hearst, because as a result of shortly after, or actually in January of 73, two of the members of the nascent SLA were arrested in connection with the murder of Marcus Foster. And the idea was to kidnap someone and trade her for the two people who were arrested for the Marcus Foster murder. So in those more innocent days, Patty Hearst was, as I'm sure you all know, the heiress to the Hearst fortune. She was William Randolph Hearst's granddaughter. She had never actually met the famous, he died, the William Randolph Hearst died before she was born, but she was, of course, a child of great wealth and privilege. And in those more innocent days, she was engaged to be married to someone named Stephen Weed, and their wedding announcement was in the newspaper, in the San Francisco Examiner, which was the Hearst paper, and it mentioned that she was an undergraduate at Berkeley. Now, one of the SLA members worked as a secretary at Berkeley, and she knew that there was a directory of all the students open to the public, a big leather book that said where everyone lived. And so they went, and they went to the big leather book, and they saw Patty Hearst, Patricia Hearst, 2603 Benvenue Street in Berkeley. So they staked it out, and they started to see what her patterns were, where she, you know, how often she left. And what they didn't know, what they couldn't know, is they found an unusually receptive and restless target. At that moment, Patty Hearst was 19 years old. She was living with her boyfriend, Stephen Weed. They were engaged to be married, but Patricia was miserable. She didn't want to marry Stephen Weed. She didn't want to admit to her parents that she didn't want to marry Stephen Weed. So she was sort of caught in this vise of indecision. Weed was this sort of arrogant jerk who didn't really cater to her needs at all, didn't listen to her, didn't involve her in the decision-making of their family. So she was miserable. And on February 4th, 1974, Donald DeFries and two others, they break into her house and they grab Patricia Hearst. Bill Harris stuffs her in a car trunk. Stephen Weed runs off in fear. The kidnapping begins. And she is taken to a house in Daly City, which is sort of a blue-collar suburb of San Francisco, and she's put in a closet. But then they open the door, and they start talking to her. And they start saying, you know, we don't want money. We don't want to get rich. We just want to have a revolution. It's true, and that's what they said. And they quickly realized that Ronald Reagan, who was governor of California at the time, was certainly not going to trade two murder suspects for Patty Hearst. I mean, it's a pretty obvious conclusion. So, again, the SLA was very, improvisational, overstates the amount of planning that they actually did. And so they said, well, what the hell are we going to do with Patty Hearst? And Donald DeFries says, I know what we'll do. We will feed the poor. We will tell William Randolph Hearst that as a good faith gesture, he has to feed the poor of Los Angeles, and he has to spend $4 million to do it. And Randy Hearst, Patricia's slightly drunken but basically likable father, says, you know what? I am going to do this for my daughter. And so in an incredibly brief period of time, they set up an organization called People in Need, and they start to feed the people, the poor people of Northern California. It doesn't work out so well. Several of the food giveaways turn into riots. They're throwing frozen legs of lamb. People get injured. It's honest to God, that's true. And it doesn't work out so well, but the process actually does start. And Patricia sees that the SLA is actually not looking to make money. And she sees, according to her captors, that, her parents are not really cooperating as the SLA wants. And she sees and she hears that the FBI and the police, they don't want, all they want is to kill us all. They're coming here to kill us all. You have nothing to fear from us. You have to fear from the police. And this impressionable young woman starts to believe what she's told. She starts to believe that, in fact, the good guys of this story are her captors. And in remarkably short order, she starts to come around to the SLA point of view. And remember, she's kidnapped on February 4th, and on May 31st, she sends a communique, a tape, that says, I have a new name. And I'm sure you all remember the name, Tanya. And that name is actually quite significant because Tanya was the partner, the girlfriend, the fellow soldier of fortune with Che Guevara in Bolivia, that who was killed with him there. And the SLA, to the extent they had any plans at all, and I certainly don't want to overstate any plans that they had, but they did actually want to model themselves after Castro in Cuba, the Tupamaros in Uruguay, the Red Brigades in Italy, the Bader-Meinhof gang in Germany, these revolutionary groups that were out and about. And Patricia starts to believe what she's told, especially by this young the youngest of the kidnappers, Willie Wolf, who was actually the closest in social class to Patricia. He's the son of a physician from New Milford, Connecticut. He went to prep school. He was a student at Berkeley. And, you know, he starts talking to her about politics, and they develop a bond. It remains controversial to this day just how much of a bond. The surviving members of the SLA say that she fell in love with Willie Wolf and voluntarily developed a relationship with him. Patricia Hearst says she was raped by Willie Wolf. And certainly, if according to modern conceptions of consent, it is difficult to imagine how a woman can consent to a sexual relationship if she is in a closet having been kidnapped. But certainly there was some kind of relationship between Willie Wolf and Patricia Hearst. And so she sends the Tanya tape on March 31st, and they start realizing, the SLA, that they need money. Like, they need money, right? And where's the money? The money's in a bank. And so they start casing a bank, but they look for a bank in particular that has a relatively new technology. Not many banks had security cameras at the time, and no camera, and none of them had video. It was just still cameras. And they looked for a bank with security cameras because they wanted to show that Patty Hearst was on their had changed sides. So they found a bank, the Hibernia Bank, in the Sunset section of San Francisco, a very quiet section of the city. And they went on April 15th, 1974, and they robbed this bank. And Patty's job was to stand precisely in the part of the bank where the security camera was pointed so that she would be in the picture all the time. And she was. Her other job was to fire her machine gun in the air. Now, that didn't work because part of the whole SLA story was their theatrical approach to their work. Now, I told you about Donald DeFries, but three of the six kidnappers came from Indiana University, where they were in the theater program. Bill and Emily Harris, honest to God, Bill and Emily Harris and Angela Atwood were in the theater program, and this was the time of guerrilla theater. This was the time of politics in the theater. And if you look at what the SLA did, the communiques, the security camera designed for the security camera, and also they laced their bullets with cyanide. Now, in fact, it doesn't really make the bullets any more deadly, but it's like cool, right? Cyanide in the bullets. I mean, that's how they thought about these things. But Patricia's bullets, because they'd been laced with cyanide, were sufficiently damaged so that they wouldn't fire. And her gun jammed, and the bank robbery was actually pretty successful. $11,000 they netted from this bank robbery, and of course it became this tremendous sensation. It also became a metaphor for what was going on in the United States at the time, because it was not just more violence. You know, as I said, you know, there were all these bombings, all these criminal activity by the political counterculture, but here it was a daughter of the aristocracy. Even she had gone over to the dark side. So what happened next was the heat got really bad in San Francisco. So the SLA, and there were eight of them at the time, got eight plus Patricia, so nine in total. They decided to go to Los Angeles, which was Donald DeFries's hometown. They moved out. So they moved there. They settled into a small house, and they started to go, not surprisingly, a bit stir-crazy. And on May 16th, a month after the bank robbery, Patricia and Bill and Emily Harris decided to go shopping, right? I mean, they were bored in the house. They wanted to go shopping. And so they went out. They bought groceries. And then they decided they needed some, clothing. and they needed they went to a sporting goods store, Mel's Sporting Goods. Now Patricia was of course still very much sought after, and so Patricia decided they'd leave Patricia in the car alone. They had a van, a stolen van that they were living that they were driving, and Bill and Emily Harris went inside to Mel's Sporting Goods. Now just think about that for a minute in and of itself. Patricia is alone in a van with the key in the ignition, by herself across a busy street. She could have walked away. She could have gone home. She could have gone to the police. She could have gone to a hospital. But in fact, she waited for Bill and Emily Harris to come out of Mel's Sporting Goods. Well, Bill Harris, genius that he was, decided, well, I don't really want to pay for all this stuff, so I'm going to shoplift some of it. The clerk in the store was studying to be a police officer. And he knew that the crime of shoplifting does not actually take place until the shoplifter leaves the store. So he had seen Bill stuff a bandolier and some socks in his pocket, but he didn't do anything until Bill left the store. And once Bill left the store, he tackled him out on the street right in front of the store, and passersby jumped in, and Emily Harris jumped in to try to free Bill, and Patricia was across the street in the van by herself. So what did she do? What did Patricia Hearst do? Did she leave? Did she watch to see what happened? No. She picked up a machine gun that was in the back of the van, poked it out the window, and emptied the cartridge into Mel's Sporting Goods, miraculously not killing or hitting anyone. And, you know, in the spirit of Lizzie Borden, you know, the Lizzie Borden thing, Lizzie Borden took an axe and gave her father 40 whacks, and when she saw what she had done, she gave her father 41. She emptied the first cartridge, and then she got another gun and emptied that gun to try to free Bill Harris. Again, miraculously not hitting anyone, but successfully freeing Bill Harris from, the aspiring police officer said, shit, I'm not going to get killed for this. I'm like, I'm getting out of here. And Bill and Emily ran across the street, and they took off. Now, this separated Bill, Emily, and Patricia from the other six SLA members. And Emily had had a summer job at Disneyland a few years earlier, and they went to a motel across the street from Disneyland to wait out what was going to happen. And they got there at about 5 o'clock on the following day, May 17th, 1974, and they turned on the television, like millions and millions of other Americans, because the LAPD had surrounded this small house where the six remaining SLA members remained. And up to that point, there had been something. Live television consisted almost entirely actually, of planned events, like World Series games, political conventions, where you could lay cable. But there was a station in Los Angeles called KNXT that had purchased something where you had a satellite that you could put on a truck. And this was so new that KNXT actually gave it its name. They called it the Minicam, which it's still called the Minicam to this day. But they brought their Minicam to 54th Street in South Central LA and trained their cameras on this house. And what followed was, to this day, the biggest police shootout in American history. 5,000 rounds of ammunition go into the house. 3,000 rounds of ammunition come out of the house. Ultimately, the LAPD throws in the kind of tear gas that lights on fire, and all of the six SLA members inside, including Willie Wolfe, including Donald DeFries, are killed. As Patricia, Bill, and Emily watch on television from Disneyland a few miles away. Keep in mind, this is what the SLA had been saying to Patricia all along. they're trying to kill us all. And then they almost did. And the LAPD, as they acknowledge, they thought Patricia was in the house during all this. So it wasn't like they were holding back. They thought Patricia was in the house. And she, and May 17th, 1974, begins what is known among Patty Hearst fans as Patty's lost year. And she goes on the run. She goes to Pennsylvania. She goes to New York City. She goes to 317 West 90th Street. And I note parenthetically that as a 14-year-old kid, I was living on the same block with my parents. Like, what are the odds, right? And I, to my knowledge, I didn't see her. And during that year, she commits an extraordinary number of crimes. They rob two more banks in Sacramento. During one of those bank robberies, a woman is killed. They bomb several police stations and other official locations in Northern California. And it is not until September 15th, 1975, almost a year and a half later, 19 months, as Bradley said, that she's arrested. There's a trial. She's convicted of bank robbery. She is sentenced to 7 years in prison. But after 22 months, after an enormous campaign from people like Ronald Reagan, a close friend of the Hearst family, John Wayne, the actor, Leo Ryan, the congressman from the area, and one event really turns the tide to get Patricia her commutation. And that is the People's Temple suicides in Guyana. Now, as I'm sure many of you remember, Jim Jones was this charismatic lunatic who got a lot of San Franciscos to move with him to Guyana. When Leo Ryan and others came to investigate, he persuaded them all, 900 of them, to commit suicide by drinking poison Kool-Aid. This is where it's funny how many people know the expression "drink the Kool-Aid," but a lot of people don't even remember the origin of it, which is really deeply sinister when you think about it. They all kill themselves. So the idea of brainwashing was very much in the air. Jimmy Carter commutes her sentence after 22 months. She marries her bodyguard. She moves to the New York suburbs. 20 years later, she gets a pardon from Bill Clinton. And Patty Hearst is, to this day, the only person in America to receive a commutation from one president and a pardon from another. And when you think about the scope and the magnitude of Patty Hearst's crimes, the fact that she got those two acts of presidential grace is the purest example of the privilege that she had from her wealth and celebrity. And that's kind of the story. I think I should stop talking now and invite your questions. So, hello. So speak in the microphone, please. There's one there, and there's another one here. And please
start. Yeah, hi, Jeff. Paul Kaminar.
Hi, Paul.
Good to see you again. Could you tell us a little bit more, being a lawyer, you're a lawyer, without the trial, what was her defense? Was it an insanity defense? And also, second question, unrelated, if I could get your opinion on the Hinckley being released recently to...
The words that are most associated with the Patty Hearst case are brainwashing and Stockholm syndrome. Interestingly, the bank robbery in Stockholm that gave rise to the concept of the Stockholm syndrome took place in November of 1973, very shortly before the kidnapping. So it had not really seeped into popular culture yet and was not really mentioned during her trial. But brainwashing was. And her lawyer was the celebrated slash notorious F. Lee Bailey. And Bailey had been a fighter pilot during the Korean War. And the term brainwashing was invented during the Korean War because it was as a result of prisoners taken by the North Koreans who later robotically professed allegiance to the North Korean government that led to the concept of brainwashing. I, in writing American Heiress, I try to stay away from those terms, brainwashing, Stockholm syndrome, because they are not medical terms. They are journalistic terms. The defense at trial was coercion. I, Patty Hearst, was forced to commit these acts, and it was the turning point. There were two turning points in the trial. The turning point in the trial is Bailey put Patricia on the witness stand, but he did not get a clear ruling from the judge about what the scope of cross-examination should be. So in her direct testimony, she said, you know, I was coerced, I was forced to have sex, I was, you know, and when Jim Browning, the prosecutor began to cross-examine, he started to cross-examine on what about the shooting at Mel's Sporting Goods? What about the other bank robberies? And Bailey, understanding how vulnerable she was to further prosecution, made her take the fifth in front of the jury. So you can imagine how devastating it is to have the defendant sitting on the witness stand saying, I decline to answer on the grounds that it might incriminate me. And the second turning point in the trial is so interesting and so juicy and such a last-minute reversal that you have to read the book to see it.
And about Hinckley, real quick.
Oh, Hinckley? You know, I'm sort of a soft touch on these things. And you know, he's been in prison a very long time. He's been released for long periods of time. I don't think he's a danger, as far as I can tell, to the community anymore. I mean, I don't have to say how horrible the crime was he's committed. But, you know, I think one of the things we have all learned from the mass incarceration, you know, the anti-mass incarceration movement is that, you know, the difference between a 10-year sentence and a 12-year sentence is not really that great in terms of the protection from society. And here we are talking about a 37-year sentence as opposed to a 39-year sentence. So I actually think it's fine that he's been released.
He wasn't sentenced to prison. He was insane.
Insane. But I mean, it's effectively a question of when he will be released from custody, and I don't have a problem with it. Yes, sir.
Hi, Josh Luger. Good to see you again.
Hey, Josh Luger. How are you? Nice to see you.
My question is, how do you think a case like this would play in the era of social media if it were to happen today?
There would be more than one book. I wouldn't have the feel to myself. We'd be back to the OJ days where I had to beat Marsha Clark into the bookstores. You know, something I write about in the book is, you know, people talked in the Patty Hearst case about how it was the subject of obsessive press attention, and the example they gave of like how much press attention they gave it got is they'd say, it's so amazing, she was on the cover of Newsweek 7 times. Now today you would say, what's Newsweek and what's a cover, right? The world, the media world, was so much smaller. There were 3 evening news shows. There was the Today Show. There wasn't even Good Morning America, which started in 1975. People magazine started 2 months after Patty was kidnapped. I mean, when you think about what it meant to be a highly publicized case in those days, it was not anything like what we think of as highly publicized. You know, to say nothing of cable news. Now, obviously, I, you know, have thought often about the O.J. Simpson case in terms of, I mean, even the O.J. Simpson case, which was almost exactly 20 years later, that was before MSNBC, before Fox News, before the internet, before social media. So, you know, the volume and intensity of press attention has just risen enormously, and I think had there been, you know, it would have been a lot different.
Yes. Hey, Jim. Mark Zaid, I have your wanted poster.
Oh, Mark. Oh, the wanted poster, yes.
Yeah. Two questions. One, what led the police to the SLA house when they then burned it down? And second, since you weren't able to interview her, but you obviously poured through her book line by line, besides the notion of being coerced versus voluntarily participating, what was in that book that in your book you've been able to directly contradict?
Okay. How did they find the house where the shootout took place? Well, as I told you, there was, you know, Bill and Emily, after Patricia freed them from Mel's Sporting Goods, they jumped into the van and they ran and they drove off together. Now, they recognized that everyone knew that van. So Bill, I mean, there's like the craziness multiplies. So they go and they start driving off into Inglewood, California, and they see a for sale sign in a van there. And so they pull into the house and they say, oh, you know, we'd like to test drive your van. And so this 18-year-old kid named Tom Matthews comes out and says, okay, I'll go with you. And, you know, and so the four of them get into the van, and Bill Harris takes out a machine gun and says, oh, by the way, you know, we're the SLA, so we need your van. And Tom Matthews says, oh, that's okay, as long as I'm back for my high school baseball game tomorrow. Honest to God, I mean, and I, it's like Tom Matthews is my favorite person in the book. Tom is like, yeah, no, this is great. Like, wow, you really are the SLA. And Patty like takes a shine to him. They don't know what to do. They have a backup location where they go to where they're supposed to meet at a drive-in movie theater. So the four of them go to a drive-in, and they see The New Centurions, which was a Joseph Wamba movie. And that's a movie where they're cops, and the cops and they're cops who get shot in it. And Tom Matthews remembers Bill Harris, like, cheering every time the cops get shot in the movie. Well, it turns out that they don't meet up there, and that's where they eventually let Tom go to his baseball game, which he wins 1-0. And they go, and that's where they head off to Disneyland. In the original van that they left when they kidnapped Tom, they had gotten a parking ticket in front of the house where they were hiding out, and it was through the parking ticket that they got to the house. I got so involved in Tom Matthews, I don't remember your second question.
Were you able to contradict anything besides the main concept in her book?
Well, you know, her book, which is called Every Secret Thing, is really good. I mean, I don't begrudge, you know, it's actually quite a good book. It is not so much that it is that there are false things in the book, I think. It is just a question of emphasis and motivation. You know, she does discuss the shooting at Mel's drive-in, but her description of the level of coercion she was under was, I think, just not borne out by the facts. I mean, there are many stories, I mean, some of which I tell in the book, of how independently she acted during that time, and how many times she had interactions with the police. She got a case of poison oak, and she went to a hospital and got treated. But she gave a fake name instead of saying, oh, by the way, I'm Patty Hearst. Can you take me home? She was stopped for speeding with Jack Scott, who was one of the other people who was taking care of her, you know, who was clearly unarmed. And you know, she said nothing. Another time, she acknowledges more or less in the book that she falls in love with a later captor, this guy Steve Solia, who she was living with when she was arrested. They go hiking shortly before the arrest, and they get stuck on a ledge In Pacifica, California, you know, on the California coast, and the state police have to come rescue them with ropes, and they pull these ropes down, and Patricia comes up, and you know, she doesn't say, oh, by the way, can you like take me home? I'm the most notorious fugitive in America. No, she gives a fake name, and I mean, there are many opportunities for her, not. You know, to turn herself in, and that's the kind of thing that's either not in the book or I think portrayed in not in a fulsome way. Yes.
Hi, I was wondering if you got any of your research from any of the surviving SLA members or their families, and even Patty.
Patty did not cooperate.
Yes.
Yeah. And you know, I really understand that. I mean, she's in her mm-hmm. early 60s now. She. I mean, the amazing thing about Patty Hearst's life, among, I guess there are lots of amazing things, is that she has sort of led the life for which she was destined. And I don't mean this facetiously, but, you know,
actress.
Basically the whole thing turned into the junior year abroad from hell. And she went in and, you know, and she was sort of a housewife and a socialite. And she's, like, acted in a couple John Waters movies. But basically, you know, she was, you know, led a very conventional wealthy woman's life. And she now, unfortunately, you know, she married her bodyguard, Bernie Shaw. Sadly, he died in 2013. So she's now a grandmother. Her big thing now is she raises
dogs.
Dogs. Yeah, you know, the show dogs. And if you... Who are you telling, pal? You know, just look at the pictures in the book, and you will not only learn that, but you will see a photograph of Rocket, the Shih Tzu, who won the Best Kind of Cancer. I'm way ahead of you, you know. So, yes, she raises dogs. The real turning point in my research in the dogs, I'm sorry not to get there. There was a lot of dog stuff I could have put in the book, but that, you know, enough. A little goes a long way. Bill Harris,
right,
went to prison, mm-hmm. got out of prison, and became a private investigator, mm-hmm. And actually quite a good one. He was sort of this obsessive collector of things, and he decided he was going to collect. All the documents in connection with all the SLA cases, all the FBI interviews, all the transcripts, all the lawyers' documents, and he was going to sell them to a university library. Well, shortly before I met Bill, that sale fell through, mm-hmm. and I bought from Bill Harris 150 boxes of material.
Wow!
Which Amy can tell you, we got a lot of boxes in our house, that was the crucial pieces, because none of that had been seen publicly, and so Bill, that decision was cool. Was
so
very
you
helpful.
Met Bill Harris.
I met Bill Harris, who is, you know, the thing is these people. And I met Michael Borton, some of the other. I mean, they were a lot less threatening at 70 than they were at 30. You know, I really do think that, you know, one of the tragedies of having them all die, the six of them die in that shootout, is that, you know, like most mortals, they would have like chilled out and. Mm-hmm. You know, move to the suburbs. Yeah. But
have you been to the police museum in L.A. to see all?
Yes, they have. The police museum in L.A. has a lot of the mm-hmm. weaponry that was found in the in the shootout. It's great.
Very cool. Yeah. Very cool.
Yes.
Thank you.
One of the sports personalities who was involved in these events was Bill Walton, and
picture in the book.
Okay.
Yes.
And I suggested over a beer during these events that it might be good for the FBI to embed with the Portland Trailblazers and see who showed up on any road trip. Did the FBI ever pursue that line of investigation, and did Walton cooperate with you at all?
As my dad used to say, to make a long story unbearable. the short version is Bill Walton did not cooperate. I sent him an email, and he said, well, I'll give my best to Mickey Scott, who was one of the people he was with. Bill did not want to revisit this this whole incident. He was deeply involved in protecting the SLA when they were on the run. This was during the lost year. Again, the just because of the limits of time, the crucial figure in protecting them during that year was this person named Jack Scott, and actually a very fascinating person who was a very early sports activist who had an institute to protect athletes' rights in the 70s. He was actually very prescient about a lot of things, about the use of drugs and steroids. But he also had the idea of getting the SLA to write a book and make a fortune off of it. So he protected them. He actually rented a farm in Pennsylvania where he put the SLA up for a while. And the SLA, you know, Patty and Bill and Emily, they discovered, as many an author have, that it's actually not so easy to write a book. And they decided that they were sort of going nuts, and they wound up leaving Jack Scott behind. But Scott was best friends with Bill Walton and actually left that farm to live with Bill Walton in Portland when Bill was with the Trailblazers. And so there was a real symbiosis, to coin a phrase, between Walton and the SLA. Yes.
Did the newspapers and other properties of the Hearst media empire cover the unfolding Patty Hearst saga similarly or in any way differently from the rest of the media at the time?
You know, that's a really interesting question. And in fact, you know, one of the reasons I found Randy Hearst an appealing character is that he really didn't interfere much with the San Francisco Examiner's coverage of the case. You know, Randy was basically a figurehead at the San Francisco paper. William Randolph Hearst had four sons, each a bigger drunken ne'er-do-well than the next. And Randy was sort of the least drunk and the least ne'er-do-well of the four, but he was no bargain either. And he but he was a good guy, and he tried to sort of help Patty, and he tried to free her, and he set up this lunatic people in need thing. But he also didn't interfere with the coverage in his paper. And he's actually, I mean, I feel he's, you know, he's gone now, but I sort of genuine sort of admiration for him. He did not, you know, he behaved, I thought, in a good way given the circumstances. Yes.
So it seems like the residence of Jonestown explains why Jimmy Carter would commute her sentence, but what was the motivating rationale for Bill Clinton to pardon her 20 years later?
Well, I think two things. One was, as you recall, it was an incredibly chaotic process at the end of Bill Clinton's presidency. Most notoriously, the same day he pardoned Mark Rich, the fugitive, and that got most of the attention. But, you know, pardons are usually a very organized process where there's it goes through the Justice Department. But Clinton basically was operating by the seat of his pants in the last few days. And I'm sorry. You know, the 90s are over, pal, okay? He's an elder statesman, you know. Oh, the Clintons are back, you know. It's all going to start all over again. where was I? And the turning point for the pardon was that Jimmy and Rosalynn Carter wrote Bill and wrote Hillary impassioned letters, please pardon Patty Hearst. And, you know, Clinton owed his predecessor a certain deference. Clinton had never met Patty Hearst. I mean, there was no connection there. But you know, Carter, who has this, you know, religiously informed idea of redemption, thought that Patty had, you know, led a respectable life, which she certainly had over the past 20 years, and Clinton did it. I mean, but it was really the intervention of the Carters that was the key factor for Clinton. Yes.
Question on method. Can you tell us how you were able to report and write this book while at the same time covering all the other legal issues that you have to deal with on a daily basis?
Well, the key thing, answer to that, is when I have written books, this one included, is I take a leave from the New Yorker. I can't write New Yorker articles and do and write a book at the same time. And fortunately, David Remnick, the editor of The New Yorker, has been very generous in giving me 6-8 months to do that, and that's what he did in this circumstance. And my CNN work, it tends to be Situation Room, Anderson Cooper 360, Jake Tapper. I don't know if Jake is still here. I saw he was here earlier. Sort of later in the day. So I tend to have my days free to work. Oh my, that's true. And I have a mindless but very effective system for writing books, which has now stood me in good stead for 7 books, which is hard for me to believe, which is when I am writing a book, come hell or high water, I write 5 pages a day, which is 1,250 words. Mm-hmm. And believe me, I count everyone. I sometimes struggle to get there, but I write without fail 5 pages a day, you know, which starts to add up. You know, 25 pages a week, 100 pages a month, and, you know, you get a book after 8 months.
Thank you.
Yes. I'm amazed that you haven't already gotten this question just in the 5 or 7 or so that we've had already, because it always comes up here when we've had a really spellbinding presentation like this, and that is, what's the Hollywood potential here for what you've done, and if it has, assuming it has Hollywood potential, unless there's some legal things that I'm not aware of, would you like to see it done as a sort of slapstick comedy entirely, or would you want to combine the humor with something a little more meaningful?
Well, I am more than delighted to answer this question, because the movie rights have already been sold. In fact, they have been sold to Fox 2000, not for a miniseries the way the O.J. case was, the O.J. book was, but for a feature. But the same two screenwriters, Paul Alexander and Larry Karaszewski, who wrote most of the O.J. series, are writing the movie. And it is, they are wonderful screenwriters. They did The People versus Larry Flint. They did Man in the Moon about Andy Kaufman, Ed Wood, and of course, the O.J. story. So they are very experienced screenwriters. One of the keys to my success, such as it is as a journalist, is that I have never tried to be a screenwriter. You know, I know what I know, and I know what I don't know. And these guys are really good at what they do, but I am not. That's not how I think. That's not what I know how to do. So I have the strongest hope that this turns into a movie. I mean, the fact that a screenplay is being written doesn't mean that a movie will be made, but I hope it works out. I would love to see certain actors and actresses in these roles, but it's not up to me. Sorry?
As you, as Deathly Bailey.
Me, you know, I actually had a walk-on role in the OJ FX miniseries, which was so brief that I had to tell my family, watch really carefully on episode 6. But the nice thing about it was I was standing there with Robert Morris, who played Dominic Dunn. And so, in fact, I spent a great deal of time with Dominic Dunn during the actual OJ trial, so it was a nice... And of course, there was an actor who played me during... if you remember the OJ series, I wrote a story for The New Yorker that is sort of the focus of one of the episodes. And there's a wonderful young actor named Chris Connor, who is fortunately younger and better looking than I am, which was I strongly endorsed.
How about yes. the nature of the movie?
You know, I know my business, and I don't. They're going to do the movie that they're going to do. I don't tell people what kind of movie to make. I do think, and look, you know, this story, like the O.J. Simpson story, has funny stuff in it. I mean, there's Tom Matthews and his baseball game. I mean, there's lots of funny stuff in it. But one thing I have always tried to keep in mind, and I certainly kept it in mind in the O.J. thing, is that two people died. Ron and Nicole died in O.J. Marcus Foster died. Myrna Opsahl died in the third bank robbery.
Right.
So, I I think any storytelling about this has to be respectful of that tragedy. We're out of time. Well, I hope I can sign some books for you. Thank you all for your time.
Live at Politics and Prose is a co-production of The Bookstore and Slate.com. For information about upcoming Politics and Prose events, visit politics-prose.com. And please let us know what you think of this program. Our email is podcasts@slate.com.